She thought I was sick. She said, oh, it's just terrible. Living in sin and all those other things. You know, she just was horrible.
That's my friend Bill Richards. He's telling me about a conversation he had a long time ago with his mother about him being gay.
One time she said, I'd just like to know one thing. Just what do two men do together? And I said, I don't think you want to hear that. And she said, I asked you a question. I said, all right, you're going to get an answer. And I gave her a full-blown description of every kind of sex you could have. And she never asked another question ever again.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting, this is Us and Them. It's the podcast where we tell stories from America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. Several months ago, we released an episode called Revisiting the Grand Palace. The Grand Palace was the gay bar in Charleston, West Virginia, the town where I grew up. Our show was about me recently visiting my home state of West Virginia and thinking about how attitudes towards gay people had changed a good bit in the past 30 or 40 years. Days after we posted that show, I was in Charleston, and I was invited to a brunch where I met up with this guy.
My name is Bill Richards. I'm from Charleston, West Virginia, and I'm a floral designer.
I hadn't seen Bill in over 30 years. I knew him when I was a teenager, and I'd worked delivering flowers for a florist. Bill worked in the back room cutting and arranging flowers. He was a really nice guy with a great wit. I remember him keeping everyone entertained with jokes he'd crack. Bill was one of the first out gay men that I knew back then. Well, he was as out as much as one could be back in those days. Last spring, I went to the flower shop in Charleston where Bill works these days.
Hey. We can just sit right down here with this table.
Okay.
Bill grew up in Raynell, West Virginia, which is a town I know well because that's where my grandmother was from. It's a little tiny place that you get to after driving a long way over West Virginia mountains on switchback roads. Growing up in Raynell, Bill knew that he was different from the other boys.
When I was just a little tiny toddler, they told me how I used to, and my grandparents had flowered linoleum on their floors, and I used to get a brown paper bag and go around and pretend to be picking the flowers and putting them in my bag. And then I would always go out and pick dandelions and bring them in the house. And anything I found blooming, I'd be dragging them into my grandmother, especially, you know, because I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. And the only person in my family I ever heard say a derogative thing about me was my great-grandmother. And she said, that little sissy needs to be taken care of. She said, you ought to just make it a bigger sissy out of it.
Oh, and before we go any further, I think I should let you know that this program has some pretty blunt language about sex. So if you're listening with children or are uncomfortable with this kind of talk, heads up.
I had never had any problem. You know, I had sex with girls, you know, quite frequently. And I just thought that was the way things went. And when you're young and dumb and full of cum, you know. You proceed with that. So anyway, I've read a lot, paperbacks. So I was at the drugstore and I saw this paperback that said City of Night. Well, I picked it up and I read the foreword and I said, oh my gosh, I've got to have this.
City of Night was written by John Retchie and published back in 1963. It's about the travels of a young man, we never learn his name, but he makes his way around America as a hustler, and he has trysts with a bunch of peculiar characters. The book was popular in the 1960s. Some say that Jim Morrison of The Doors was influenced by it. But back in Raynell, West Virginia, City of Night was resonating with young Bill Richards in a major way.
And I flew over to the flower shop and I jump into that book and read it within, before midnight was that night, the book was absorbed, and it was about gay life in the city.
Bill says when he was a teenager, he had sex with girls and boys. He just thought he was a sexual guy. But after reading City of Night, he had a clearer understanding of who he was. He started making trips to Charleston and over to Richmond, Virginia, the closest thing to the cities described in the book. He went looking for gay bars, and in one of these joints, he met someone.
So I met this guy in Richmond, and he was moving to Chicago. Well, I just sold everything I had, was on my way to Chicago.
Bill says that he and this guy were like country boys in the big city. Their relationship ended quickly, and soon thereafter, Bill says he was hot on the scene in the town's gay clubs.
So I was there about 6 months. When I'd run out of my money, I'd call my parents, and they'd send me a little money. And so finally, one day, I asked them to send me some money. Well, when I went to Western Union to get the money, they said, well, your parents are at your apartment. So I go home, and they're there, and they have me packed up and said, you're going back to West Virginia. Well, I didn't have much choice. I came back. Before I was going to Chicago, my dad said to me, and this is terrible, but it's the only way he knew how to say it. He said, just because you're queer doesn't mean you can't make me proud that you're my son. And he said, I'm never going to say anything to your mother. Well, she figured it out. So she, and while I was in Chicago, we'd talk on the phone, and she'd say, you know, you're living a life of sin, and you're going to go to hell, and you're driving me crazy, and so on.
Bill says after his mother discovered he was gay, she'd constantly mail him clippings from Billy Graham newsletters, stuff about homosexuality being a sin.
I've had so many Billy Graham clippings and preacher clippings and things that I should have saved them. You know, people thought, they thought you were sick. You know, she thought I was sick. When I came back here, that was the same thing. Every time I'd hear from her or see her, it was that same old song and dance. So
that you're full of sin, and that, you know, yeah, you got to repent and change your ways.
Yeah, and then I started dating Ann. And
who's Ann?
Ann, well, she's the girl I married, and started dating her, and so I decided to get married. You know, that would settle things down a little bit. And of course, my mother was thrilled to death that I was going to get married. That still doesn't change your feelings, deep down inside your feelings, you know. And Ann knew that I had fooled around. And she was fine with it, she said, you know. We had a pretty happy 6 or 8 months, you know. And then I started slipping off a lot, coming to Charleston, you know, stay overnight and so on. So then we had a son, Michael, came along, and so it wasn't too long after that that I knew I just couldn't handle it anymore. But that time she said, well, just bring Frankie up here to the house. If you're going to see him, bring him up here. You need to be here at the house, you know.
Frankie was the man that Bill was seeing at the time.
So I did. And so then, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks went by or something. And I said, one day I just said to her, you know, Ann, it doesn't matter how much sex we have. You can't, you know, you could wear me out sexually, but mentally, my sexual desires are not fulfilled. So I said, I'm going to leave. And we talked about it, and she agreed. And I packed up stuff, got in the car, and she drove me to Charleston and dropped me off at Frankie's house. Well, about 3 weeks later, I was out at Clendenin, working in another little flower shop helping do a wedding for a friend of mine. And the state police came to the in the door at the flower shop, and they said they'd like to see William Robert Richards. And so I went out there, and they had a warrant for my arrest for sodomy.
In the mid to late 1960s, West Virginia, like most other states, had laws that considered certain sexual acts to be criminal. These sex acts were deemed to be unnatural or immoral and fell under the catch-all term sodomy. These laws varied greatly from state to state and were usually vague on the specifics that constituted sodomy. Generally, it was understood that sodomy meant oral and anal sex, but only when gay people did these things, not necessarily straight people.
So they gave me the choice of either being prosecuted or going to a Western State Hospital.
If you had been prosecuted, what would that have meant?
Well, I think that the time they said I'd probably spent at least 10 years in prison. 10 to 15 or something like that.
Prior to 1962, sodomy was a felony in every state, punished by a long prison term and possibly hard labor. After 62, most states started to dial down the punishments, but not all did. In Idaho, a conviction could earn a life sentence. Michigan had a maximum sentence of 15 years for first offenders, life for repeat offenders. When Bill was before a judge in 1966, West Virginia still had stiff sentences.
It was enough to scare you and shake you up pretty good. So you think, well, it'd be easier just to go away to the crazy house.
Did you think you were crazy?
No, I knew I wasn't crazy. But I thought I'll just go right on up there rather than go to jail because they, you know, well, I thought I'd be out of there and zip, you know. I didn't know they were going to slam me in maximum security for 3 months, which was just like going to prison, really.
The crazy house that Bill is referring to is the Weston State Mental Hospital. It's an enormous Gothic building that has sections that predate the Civil War. And even though it wasn't a prison, the place has kind of a scary look. It's right out of a horror film. You know, the kind of a place you'd imagine Dr. Frankenstein doing experiments.
There was like four huge dormitories. Or large, I'd say 25 in a dormitory. And those were all people from Moundsville prison, from petty thieves to murderers, lifers. And for most part, they were very, everybody was good to me.
But so nobody ever mistreated you while you were in maximum security?
No, not me. They didn't. I saw a lot of other people get mistreated. But I was never mistreated by anyone, not the... Oh, I might have got a cat call or two, you know, but never anything serious. If I hadn't lucked out through Vista Workers and got to meet Dr. Cornelius Wilbur, I could still be there. People wound up spending a lifetime in those places.
Actually, Bill couldn't still be at Weston today because the institution shut down in 1994. Today, the place has reverted to its original name, the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, and is now open to the public as a museum. The new owners stage a lot of paranormal events and all-night ghost tours on the facility grounds. But back when Bill was there, he says that he was helped by Vista workers. If you don't know what that is, they're volunteers who fight poverty. Vista is like the Peace Corps, but the volunteers work in the U.S., not overseas. But did you catch that name, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur? The doctor that the Vista workers introduced Bill to?
They're everywhere. No, you keep them away from me. I will do it. I will do it.
Back in the 1970s, Sally Field starred in a movie about a woman who'd been diagnosed with multiple personality disorder. Dr. Cornelia Wilbur was the real-life psychologist who worked with the woman known as Sybil.
Sybil? I hate Sybil. I hate her.
Who are you?
And Dr. Wilbur was superintendent at Weston Hospital when Bill was there.
When you mentioned her name, I knew her as being famous. What did you know about her?
I had no clue except Joe, the Vista worker, told me that she had a book that she had, a book that she had collaborated with a lot of people on. And actually, Joe brought me the book to read right while I was there in the hospital, which I read, and it had everybody's views on what the, you know, where they had done this psychoanalytic study of homosexuality. But I had had no idea that she was had done Sybil and all those things at all.
And what was she like? Describe what it was like.
Well, if you ever saw the movie Sybil, Joanne Woodward was her made over. I swear to you, looks and everything. I was just, when that movie came out, I thought, how in the world could anybody look so much like her and move so much like her?
Yeah, you asked your father about seeing me. What happened? What did he say? Sybil?
I talked to her many times. I almost had open door access to her because I turned a lot of things in that were going on at the facilities, you know, wrong things. And so I almost had open door policy with her. And so she would let me go out to where the Vista workers lived for cookouts and things, which I was lucky about that, you know, that she would give me a pass to be out for 4 hours or something like that in the evenings. But she made you feel so very good, you know. She just, I can't explain just how to go sit down and talk with somebody that's that intelligent and that can tell you about yourself, who you are and where you are, and then you sit back and realize that, you know, she's telling you the really truth that you've been trying to kick out of your head.
So everybody had been telling you, your mother and everybody else, is that you're gay, it's wrong, it's a sin.
Yeah.
You need to go to some place to kind of work out this yeah. pathology that's within you. And Dr. Wilbur said something different.
Oh, no. Dr. Wilbur said from day one, she said, you know, I truly believe that you are born a homosexual. And she is the woman that convinced my mother that to be gay was normal for me. After that, my mother never sent another Billy Graham clipping, never did another thing. She was fine. It was just like the preacher had told her or something, you know, because that was her thing. And from then on, there was never a problem. And, you know, I had lovers, and she was totally accepting. And like I had a black lover, and you would have thought would never work. Took him home all the time. My brother-in-law once said, she invited us up for Thanksgiving. My brother-in-law said, I'm not going to eat at a table with a nigger. And my mother said, well, I guess you won't be having dinner, will you? So, I mean, no, it changed her whole aspect on everything. And my last lover I had, we were together 15 years, and my mother loved him so much, and she insisted he be in her obituary, even though we had split up, and he certainly was in her obituary.
Wow. Basically, you're saying that transformation really was caused by was by Dr. Cornelius?
Absolutely was. I mean, there is no other way about it. It was just like day and night.
It was Dr. Wilbur who got Bill released from Weston State Hospital. It took about 6 months, but she told the sheriff that Bill wasn't insane and that they either needed to charge him or let him go.
And they took me back to Somersville, and the sheriff said I was free to go, and they never wanted to see me in Nicholas County again.
So Bill moved to Charleston, West Virginia, and made a life for himself, apart from his wife and son. He found a job as a floral designer and began to mix in with the underground gay culture there. Bill is now in his 70s, and he's seen the town become more and more accepting to gay and lesbian people. He lost many friends during the AIDS crisis. About 20 years ago, he helped start the gay pride celebrations in Charleston. Why? Because he's proud of being gay, and he loves where he comes from.
I've visited plenty of places and really enjoy it when I go and visit. But to live there, I'd have to be a millionaire to just go to the shows I want to go to and to do all the things I want to do.
So here in West Virginia, it's more your speed.
Yeah. Overall, I like the laid-backness of it, the friendliness of people.
And things have evolved. Things have changed.
Oh, very much. My God, I mean, I've lived so many things. The AIDS crisis, I've lived through it all. I mean, it's had its real ups and its real downs.
Bill's divorce from Ann was certainly one of the downs. A stipulation in their divorce agreement was that Bill would never have contact with his son. He abided by that. Ann told their son, Michael, that Bill had died in Vietnam.
Finally, the last part of his teenage years, she did admit to him that, you know, that I was a good person. She never did say gay. She said, very talented man. But meantime, he had just kind of figured it out in his mind that I was gay, with a little bit of help from some cousins.
A couple of years ago, Bill got a phone call, and it was his son. He's talked with Michael a bit over the years, and they've connected somewhat, but they've never really gotten close.
Okay, so the circumstances were what they were, but if you could go back and do it again, would you want to have a relationship with him?
Probably now that I've met him and everything, I probably would have, but it was like getting out of a cage to be able to be gay and be free and be gay, you know?
And that was kind of like a necessary thing that you would have to give up to kind of live.
Yeah, to just live the life I wanted to live.
Bill Richards' story is an example of the complicated history that we've been through over the past 50 or 60 years, and how much the acceptance for gay and lesbian people has grown recently, really at a rapid pace. I mean, we've come a long way from policing the sexual conduct of two consenting adults and bundling gay people off to the booby hatch for violating so-called sodomy laws. What touches me most about Bill's story is how there seemed to be an intractable us-and-them barrier between Bill and his mom. And after a good amount of pain and frustration, love and acceptance seemed to win the day. But what breaks my heart is that Bill felt that he had to make an either-or decision over living his life authentically or having a relationship with his son. Here's to the day when folks can be like Bill's mom and welcome everyone to the dinner table. You've been listening to Us and Them. Our show was produced by me, Trey Kay, and Laurie Stern, and was mixed by Mitch Hanley. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. The wonderful people at West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation. Hey, before we go, I'd like to tell you about a great new podcast that I believe shares the Us and Them ethos of tapping into situations of how people on opposite sides of the culture war divide interact with one another. The show is called Scene on Radio.
S-C-E.
Scene.
Scene on Radio.
Get it? It's Scene, S-C-E-N-E, on radio, and it's produced by our friend John Bewin of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. It's really fantastic stuff. In the first couple of episodes, John focuses on the culture war scenes that take place over sporting events. Here's a clip that looks at the racial climate in St. Louis through the lens of a Cardinals baseball game.
On this game day, though, maybe the most noteworthy appearance by African Americans at Busch Stadium is a protest.
Justice for Mike Brown! Justice for Mike Brown!
My name is Mustafa Hussein with Argus Streaming News. I have been live streaming the events in St. Louis surrounding the Michael Brown shooting.
During the game I attended, Hussein shot 25 minutes of video that went viral in the following days.
And it got pretty tense.
In fact, it got ugly. The video showed about 25 mostly black demonstrators just outside Bush Stadium chanting things like justice for Mike Brown, but also briefly, we want Darren Wilson, and how do we want him? Dead, like he left Mike Brown.
How we want him dead! They left Mike Brown dead!
Dozens of mostly white Cardinals fans stand nearby in the stadium's outdoor smoking area.
One of the first things that I had heard in the smoking area was, you know, pro Darren Wilson chants. And then chanting USA. At that point, someone began chanting Africa back at the demonstrators.
USA! 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 USA!
Ice cold beer!
Inside the stadium, things are more harmonious. I chat with a guy named Ryan Ayler, who's here with his wife and some friends. He's white, he's about 30 years old, and lives 45 minutes north of St. Louis. I ask him about the idea that sports brings communities together.
I think it tries. I think that there still are. Inequalities in this world for different races, different sexes, what your beliefs are. But I think that brings that together.
This game here, I'm looking around, I think St. Louis is about 50% African American, right?
Right.
Look around here. Who's here? Who's at the game?
About 80% white.
You think that's all?
Probably 85 to 90. I would say that...
Can I get 95?
I would say that a lot of the folks that are in yellow are African American.
Those are who?
Concession workers.
Check out Scene on Radio. And for the next time on Us and Them, we want to hear from you. Are we presenting a conversation that bridges the culture divide? Or are we just preaching to the choir? We've heard what some of you had to say.
I think your attempt is quite commendable, but doubt it's going to change any minds because too many think they know it all.
So the case you make just doesn't seem to be holding much water, hearing her comments about slavery on the podcast.
I actually was getting really irritated by all the other people of my own like mind, since I actually want to hear their opinions and I want to hear, you know, how they feel. Are they listening to this? Because otherwise, basically, I'm just listening to my own choir and I want to hear their choir too.
We'd like to hear more of your thoughts about the conversations we've had. Send us your comments or ideas for future shows to trey@usandthempodcast.com. That address can also be found at our website, usandthempodcast.com. And remember, there's no ampersand in the web address. And better yet, take out your smartphone and send us your thoughts in a voice memo to that same email address. We're looking forward to connecting with you again on Us and Them.